a Birdificer creation.
Welcome to episode 156 of the Let's Talk Apple podcast. This is the show for August 2026. It was recorded on September 7th, 2026, and I'm your host, Bart Puschatz. This may traditionally be the silly season in terms of news, but that doesn't mean we don't have quite a lot to talk about, so without more faffing about, let's get stuck in. Starting with some updates and follow-ups to stories we have talked about before. Last month, we had the launch of Apple's new Apple Upgrade program in the United States, and one of the things I was a little perplexed by was why users of this plan to get an iPhone were forced to get a contract from one of the big carriers, AT&T, T-Mobile, or Verizon. Why couldn't they use one of the many cheaper MVNOs? Well, one possible answer, Apple haven't given us an official answer, but there was an interesting article on the Mac Observer that hinted at two very good plausible answers, citing people who are familiar with previous such negotiations. Firstly, they say that the major carriers offer excellent credit checks, which saves Klarna/Apple the effort of doing that, so they're basically piggybacking off that work. And also, Apple tend to have big, wide-ranging deals with these carriers, and this may have been used as a way to sweeten the deal for, let's say, the iPhone 18 pricing and so forth when it comes to these major carriers. So they seem like the two most likely reasons for the apparently strange limitation. Apple were also not done raising prices even last month. They did their really, really big price increase 2 months ago, but last month there were still some more shoes to drop. We have, in this case, it's Apple TV and Apple One in the United States that have gone up in price. So Apple TV has gone up from $12.99 to $14.99 for 1 month. The annual subscription from $99 to $119. And the Apple One individual plan has also gone up from $19.95 to $21.95. Not huge price increases, but significant nonetheless. And again, Apple are continuing to get their income more in line with their very much increased expenditures. Apple are also continuing to roll out their back-to-school offers. It is that time of year, after all. The offers for Europe are now live, basically gift cards like in the US. And the offer in the US has been extended until the 24th of September. Apple is also continuing to invest in its supply chain, not only in the United States, where it's politically very astute to do so, but also in other countries. So first off, we have a new advanced manufacturing center in Houston, which is obviously in the United States. Then we have an iPhone, Mac, and Apple Vision Pro Apple Education Campus for suppliers in Vietnam. And then we have the Corning plant in Kentucky, where there will be 200 new roles for Apple-related work there. Apple's controversial Apple Maps ads have gone live in the US and Canada. In mid-August, businesses could start buying those ads, and by the end of August it went live. There's a link in the show notes to the coverage from Cult of Mac, which is, I think, very level-headed. It gives some reasons why users are cranky. The biggest one being that users are complaining that Apple sell premium products for a premium price. Being shown ads feels like nickel and diming or double dipping, which is exactly the issue I have when I buy expensive content plans and then get shown ads too. So I actually frankly think this really, really undercuts Apple's brand. It's not about the minor inconvenience of the not, as ads go, not actually too obtrusive ads. Certainly, if you contrast what Apple are doing to what Google do on Google Maps, Apple look amazing. But Google don't charge you in the same way Apple do. So it's a real betrayal, frankly, of Apple's principles here. This is the downside of Tim Cook's absolute obsession with services revenue. And I am hopeful, maybe there will be a little bit less of selling the shop and, you know, flushing Apple's reputation slowly but surely down the toilet for a few extra cent. Oh, I didn't actually mean to get on that little soapbox again, but hey, look what happens. If you are nostalgic for the Intel Era Max, perhaps because your central heating has broken down and you need some help heating your home, well, I'm sorry to say that era is coming ever closer to its absolute end. You can now submit apps to the Mac App Store that do not support Intel machines anymore. And finally, more Trump topological tantrums. I could not resist that little bit of wordplay there. Yes, the President of the United States has signed an executive order to rename Lake Ontario as Lake America. This is utterly disconnected from reality or history, as is the norm, because, of course, the lake isn't named for the Canadian province. It's literally the other way around. So, okay, if you think this is how you do trade talks, you are just not here on planet Earth with the rest of us. But okay, fine. The way this works is that there is an official US government-controlled database called GIS, I think it is, something like that, and that lists all the official names of things in the United States. And so what the only thing the president has the power to do is to update that US government database. That database, however, powers mapping services in the United States. And if you are a cartography company, you are free to make your own database. But most of the major providers are not cartography companies. They are consumers of map data from others. And so they use the official database as their source of things, which is why, as the database was updated and that update was pulled into the various clones of the database within the major services, Google Maps was first to rename the lake for users in the United States only, of course. And Apple was a little bit slower. For a while, everyone was optimistic that Apple would not do what they were obviously going to do all along. And I was pretty darn sure they were being very, very wildly optimistic. First, searching for Lake Ontario would give you... bring up Lake Ontario... No, sorry, I'm reading it literally backwards. If you searched for Lake America, it brought you to Lake Ontario, but it was still called Lake Ontario. And the very next day, Lake Ontario became Lake America for users in the United States. So, of course, those of us in the rest of the world continue to see sane names on these things, including, frankly, the Gulf of Mexico still to this day, because no matter how often you rename it to the Gulf of America, it doesn't achieve a darn thing, only in the mind of a narcissist idiot. Ooh, wow, I've gotten very high on my soapbox here. This isn't important, and yet it's irksome. MapQuest are not consumers of other people's databases. MapQuest are much more like cartographers. They build their own database, and they have decided, again, to defy this meaningless order and to continue to use the name that has been in use for hundreds of years and that everyone recognizes. And not just that, they've decided to poke a little fun at the administration by allowing you to name it whatever you like yourself in your own copy of the app. And in response, their app jumped to number one in the mapping category in Apple's App Store in the United States. Because, strangely enough, silly, daft things are not actually as popular as you might think. My general opinion on this is basically that it is not Apple or Google's place to become cartographers. They are consumers of the official government database, and America is a democracy to some extent anyway, and the American people voted in an idiot who changed the database, so of course the database is reflected. What shouldn't happen is that that change affects the rest of the world, but Apple and Google have a very, very long history of dealing with that fact because, as it happens, there are many, many, many governments around the world who get very, very, very tetchy about the names of things on maps, and so Apple show different names for different things in different jurisdictions all over the world. Normally, these kind of disputes arise from authoritarian dictators and failed states like, say, North Korea, as opposed to supposedly world-leading states like the United States of America, but hey, that's neither here nor there. We live in unusual times. So Andy Natko has written this up quite well with a lot of fun phraseology and a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but link in the show notes, lesterstalk.ie, to Andy Natko's take on this. That's basically my take too. It's not Apple's place to pick this fight, and they it's not something Apple should be spending their time on. And everyone in America who wants to see realistic names is free to just set their default location in Apple Maps to not be the United States. And then you'll see the names the rest of us here on planet Earth see, just like we do. We have just one story in our regulatory rundown, and it's not even a bad one. German regulators have ruled on an ad industry complaint about app tracking transparency. This is an example of ad companies in Europe trying to use European regulations on, well, frankly, they're anti, they're competition regulations, trying to pervert them into anti-privacy regulations. But Europe also has privacy rules. So this is happening quite a lot in France and Germany. And so this German ruling is one I've been waiting to see. Well, the TLDR is that app tracking transparency gets to stay. The ad industry has failed to remove app tracking transparency in Germany, at least. Not as certain in France. Last time I remember checking in on what's going on over there. But nonetheless, this is significant. And rather than paraphrasing what the German Federal Cartel Office had to say on the matter, I'm simply going to quote from their statement. Apple is allowed to provide for a level of protection for its users that exceeds the minimum legal requirements. However, if Apple sets up additional rules within its ecosystem for use of data, these rules must, under Germany's special abuse provision for large digital companies, not treat its own offerings better than those of its competitors. This is precisely where our competition concerns arose. Apple will now align the consistent requests much more closely and give third-party app providers more freedom to combine the necessary requests in a sensible way. Basically, app tracking transparency stays, but all apps, regardless of who makes them, gets to do it in the same way. This seems like an utterly reasonable compromise. Legal latest is a much busier category than regulatory rundown this month. Starting with a nice, quick and easy follow-up from last month, where last we left the Apple case against the leaker John Prosser, we had an apparent sign of some sort of a new cooperation between the parties. We had Apple choosing to allow the court to set aside a preliminary judgment that was actually in Apple's favour, and we had John Prosser starting to cooperate with the court, filing briefs, etc. And then the month started this month by everything going back on pause. Basically, John Prosser's had a baby, and therefore he needs a great big extension before getting that evidence he just promised to provide. I'm not against the concept of fathers having an active part and of there being some sort of accommodation for that in the legal system, but it seems a little rich to stick your finger in your ear for a year and intentionally not cooperate and then say, okay, fine, I will cooperate, but not just yet. I don't know. It feels a bit off to me, but hey, the court agreed, so that's what's happening. More pausing. It's now been over a year since the iOS 27 leaks. Still dragging on because that's how legal cases go, I guess. Another sort of little follow-up, the Department of Justice's ill-conceived antitrust case against Apple had some small amounts of movement this month, where last we left our story, Apple had been granted discovery of documents in various US government departments where those departments had evaluated all the different possible providers and had chosen Apple. And so Apple wanted to be able to present as evidence against it being an antitrust thing why it is that Apple won those cases. Why did Apple win those government contracts? And the documentation there is very much in favor of Apple not being a monopolist. And the DOJ, realizing how much egg would land on their face, were very much against these documents being permitted. And Apple had won, and the DOJ had filed an appeal of Apple winning. Apple then filed a response to the appeal. That was the start of August. And then near the end of the month, the court sided with Apple. No, you really can have that discovery we already granted you a month ago. So on the whole, yes, there was activity this month, but we actually haven't moved forward in any sort of meaningful way. In very stark contrast is the Apple OpenAI case, where Apple sued OpenAI last month over trade secrets theft. That case has been exceptionally active. where the legal briefs almost appear to be coming as fast as basically as fast as social media posts by normal people. It is absolutely astonishing how much has been happening. A little bit of context that became more clear as the month started is that Apple does things in a weird way. Now, I mentioned this last month because it makes me very cranky that Apple don't actually support multiple Apple IDs. But it remains true, and the Mac Observer explained it very well, that neither macOS nor iOS can handle multiple Apple IDs on a single account. This means you can't easily use the same device for personal and work. Now, Microsoft don't have any of these kind of things. I can be logged into, in fact, I am regularly logged into multiple Microsoft identities at the same time on some of my devices because it makes, you know, we're the kind of nerdy family who have a corporate Microsoft plan for the family, and I have a corporate Microsoft plan with my work hat on, and there are devices, like I only have one phone, and so my phone is logged into both. That is not a problem at all, at all, at all. But Apple simply cannot handle this. This is a major shortcoming of how Apple IDs work, and rather than bringing Apple ID into the 21st century, Apple's approach is to encourage their staff to use their personal Apple IDs for work stuff, breaking absolutely every bit of best practice you could possibly imagine. And yes, I am a cybersecurity specialist by day, so I'm very much putting my professional hat on here. That's bloody daft. That's the wrong fix to a very real problem. So they've sort of bodged a workaround where there's a special type of iCloud folder, which if you get a special secret hidden flag on your Apple ID, you can then be added to these super secret hidden shared iCloud folders. So Apple have bodged a solution only for themselves instead of fixing a genuine industry problem for everyone. And the argument being made by OpenAI is that, well, this bodge of Apple's is entirely Apple's fault, nothing to do with us, therefore no case here. Now, that's actually not a good legal argument, but leaving that aside, that context definitely exists. OpenAI, when last we left our story, had made two public non-denial denials, and I mocked them pretty mercilessly because at no point in their public postings did they actually deny the accusations. They started the month in the same vein by posting a third public reply, blaming the strange iCloud setup again. And again, not actually denying anything, which I thought, oh great, another month of the same. Apple then escalated by demanding an injunction against OpenAI releasing their rumoured, or actually no, we know they have a product in the works, we don't know anything about it, but we know it's in the works and that Johnny Ive is involved. So basically Apple wanted an injunction, they wanted expedited discovery, and they wanted expedited testimony to prevent more harm. Now that obviously raised the stakes a bit. Apple also went out of their way in their court filings to address the iCloud point head on and explain that, yeah, they didn't say, yes, we have a weird iCloud setup. I guess that's sort of taken as granted. They didn't dispute the fact that they have a weird iCloud setup, but they did very clearly say that literally nothing that they cited in their actual legal filings involves files hosted on this weird iCloud system. So it isn't actually relevant. OpenAI then actually filed an actual legal response instead of a PR response, and in their legal response they genuinely did actually deny the accusations. And they went so far as to say, not only do we deny these accusations, we assert they are so ridiculous that the entire case should be dismissed immediately because Apple haven't made specific enough accusations. Apple then responded, saying OpenAI's distortion and speculation warrant denying suit dismissal. Yeah, I guess they would say that, wouldn't they? Apple then followed that up with another filing requesting, again, with more urgency, their injunction and their expedited discovery, saying that ever more harm is being caused every day. So doubling down again, or quadrupling down, I guess. OpenAI then replied to Apple's reply, and they now basically have a new petition to dismiss. And their main points, summarized by the Mac Observer, and their summary then summarized by me, is that Apple doesn't specify specific trade secrets. Apple has not shown reasonable steps to protect their data. This is the weird iCloud setup stuff. Apple failed to prove any former employees or partner companies misused anything. No clear evidence of actual harm or financial damage, and accusations rely on wild guesses. I don't think that really stacks up, having read as much as I have about this case, but that is the official reply coming from OpenAI, and it's not my case to judge whether or not that's a good reply, because I'm neither the jury nor the judge. Don't even know if this is a jury trial. Anyway, I'm not the judge, so literally it doesn't matter what I think. Apple then replied back again, this time with very specific evidence from their forensic examination of former Apple VP Chang Liu's laptop, citing specific acts and specific pieces of intellectual property and evidence of destruction of evidence. Which is, again, Apple then again said, yeah, see, expedited, look, they're destroying evidence. And finally, OpenAI replied yet again, saying, it's not our fault if you can't keep your trade secrets, Apple. Basically, to quote Apple Insider, OpenAI has responded to Apple's latest filing about the theft of confidential information by filing its own rebuttal, which again accuses the company of trying to stop employees leaving. According to Reuters, OpenAI is now also calling out Apple for being behind on AI. So now using legal documents to sling mud instead of make legal arguments. Interestingly, Apple Insider took a little bit of initiative here that I very much appreciate. They engaged a lawyer and asked for a legal opinion rather than just guessing at it. And their lawyer gave the legal opinion that OpenAI is fighting an uphill battle here, and this argument isn't a very good one, which is kind of what I thought anyway. So glad to see an actual lawyer and me are on a vaguely same page on this. Only time will tell, of course, but that is a rather lot of stuff in the month of August and the first few days of September. Apple versus Epic is also chugging along, but not nearly as fast, but still significantly. So Apple's last-minute attempt to delay needing to file their proposed new App Store fee structure was rejected by the local court. That gave Apple just 24 hours to do what they'd already had weeks to do before. They really did have so much time to prepare for that known deadline. When their last-minute request for a last-minute pause was rejected, Apple ran back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sort of gave them a stay of 24 hours. The Supreme Court went, oh my God, yeah, 24 hours is far too little. Have an extra 24, that's twice as much. Apple then managed to find the brief that they had probably been working on all along and filed it with the court at something like 15 minutes before the deadline. They're proposing a 15% standard rate for external purchases outside of the App Store. Remember, this whole thing is about external purchases. So they're proposing a 15% standard rate in the United States, again, US only. Then they say 10% for a new partner program, or the news partner program, video partner program, mini apps partner program, and subscription renewals. 5% for the small business program. So that's developers that make less than 1 million per year. And those other three programs, by the way, are the special sweetheart deals that people like Amazon and so forth get. Epic have 60 days to reply in court, and they haven't replied in court. Wait, no. They have, sort of. Let's go. Okay. They haven't replied to those fees in court. But they immediately took to X, or rather their CEO immediately took to X, and they disagree completely because anything above zero is too high in their opinion. Apple requests that some parts of their filing detailing their proposed fee structure remain sealed. They basically had to propose a fee structure and to justify it, and the justification contains what Apple are calling sensitive financial information. Epic replied to that same filing saying, no, open up the kimono, show the world how much money Apple makes in this App Store. No idea how the court is going to respond, but as things stand, we have not yet seen those numbers. If Apple get their way, we never will. If Epic get their way, we all will. Stay tuned. And then finally, Apple asked the court to order a formal settlement conference to agree these new terms. Epic filed a reply pretty much immediately saying, there's no point. We are not within settlement territory here. We disagree with Apple too strongly for that. We remain good faith, yada, 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 but we don't see the point. They're probably right. The sides are extremely far apart. And then finally, a Californian state appeals court has revived a 2022 lawsuit about Apple's screen repair policies. Specifically, there were people in California discouraged from using third-party repairs, and that may be illegal under Californian law, to proactively discourage cheaper alternatives. So that case, it hasn't been ruled on, but that had been dismissed, and it has now been undismissed and is now back on again. So we shall see how that evolves. In terms of HR and acquisition news, the first thing we have is a settlement in a lawsuit about religious discrimination against a Jewish employee. And I believe I was fairly critical of Apple at the time. We're dealing with Apple stores, physical Apple stores in the United States, and there was an employee who converted to Orthodox Judaism and requested that their part-time schedule accommodate the fact that they are really not supposed to work on the Shabbat. And Apple wouldn't accommodate them. And the employee was like, well, I'm in a state where we have religious freedom rights and so forth, and I think you're violating my rights. And yep, that is exactly what was adjudged to be the case. So the employee is getting back pay for all the time they've been off work till now, and punitive damages as well, and Apple will provide training to the relevant employees running their stores so that they don't break laws about religious freedom and so forth. On the whole, it strikes me that Apple probably should have just eaten some humble pie and not made a case out of this, but hey, what do I know? Again, I'm no expert on HR either. Apple Pay and Apple Card VP Jennifer Bailey is retiring, no replacement announced yet. Apple has picked up someone called Nate Gatten as their new head of government affairs. Gatten comes from the American Airlines Group, where he held the same role for almost a decade. Previously, he led the global government relations policy team at JP Morgan Chase, is how Apple Insider summarized his CV. And then the last story is one that initially wasn't going to make the cut because it started off as an unconfirmed report, but then Apple sort of kind of confirmed it and said, oh yeah, but the staff can apply for other roles within Apple. We have a number that may or may not be accurate saying basically Apple cuts more than 200 jobs across Vision Pro and AI and Siri. Vision Pro, Siri and AI teams is what the Mac Observer is saying. Later reporting suggests the cuts kind of go further than that. And this is basically because the stuff in Vision Pro is not only in Vision Pro. It's not islanded off in one part of Apple because Apple have a very flat corporate structure. So if you think about it logically, if you basically change the focus, and they're not talking about getting rid of the Vision Pro, they're talking about shifting, according to the reports, about shifting the focus away from content and towards other uses, which lines up nicely with a related story saying that a company called Stryker has launched the first FDA-approved surgical app for the Vision Pro. Because one place those Vision Pros are finding immense success is in the medical world. And basically, if the rumor mill is to be believed, we are not looking at the demise of the Vision Pro. We are looking at a change in focus, a bit like the first iterations of the Apple Watch didn't do when Apple thought they would, or rather the bits of it they thought would be big were not big, and the bits of it they didn't think would be big turned out to be big, and they refocused for later versions of the watch. It would appear there are similar things happening in the Vision Pro area. We shall see. In terms of Apple services and original content, then, Apple Arcade has more games. This really is becoming a thing they're doing absolutely every month now. Again, I'm just going to quote Apple's press release. Apple Arcade's lineup of hit puzzle games gets even bigger with the addition of Block Blast, which has an exclamation point on the end, plus, and Art of Fauna Cozy Puzzles, plus. Meanwhile, Sneaky Sasquatch, which is a game that Apple bought, is getting an update. To quote Apple PR again, Sneaky Sasquatch fans are in for a big treat on Apple Arcade with an exciting crossover, a new sneaky adventure, and birthday stickers in messages. Basically, it's a collaboration with Subway Surfers Plus. I don't play any of these games. Literally not a single word of anything I've read mean anything to me, so I shall avoid commentary. In Apple TV land, the BBC hit series Small Profits has been bought by Apple. So this is a rare example of Apple buying in a successful UK comedy, which they are now bringing to the world. Meanwhile, one of Apple's first breakout hits, Ted Lasso, has started its fourth season. It did so with a bang, becoming Apple TV's biggest launch ever. And that's not entirely accidental. It's because it's a really popular show, and I, for one, was so happy to see it back. But also, they did a lot of media and stuff. So we had a Ted Lasso lookalike competition in Apple's Fifth Avenue store, which I'm sure was great fun. And also an interesting ad where Ted Lasso sort of appears in other Apple shows in the ad. So Severance, Silo and more in a clever TV commercial, as the Mac Observer put it. If you're curious, the video is embedded in the Mac Observer article linked in the show notes at les-talk.ie. Apple then, United States only, as best as I can tell, added 19 classic movies. So this again is content Apple haven't created on Apple TV. So we had the Small Prophet show from the BBC coming over, and now we have classic movies coming over. There were 19 of them added, and they were available for a few weeks, and everyone assumed they would only be limited time because Apple did something similar, I think, for Martin Luther King Day one year. And then literally a few weeks later, 15 of those titles became Leaving Soon, and then 50 new titles were announced at the start of September. So it would appear that there will continue to be classic movies for a while, but they seem to be rotating, which is also interesting. Apple TV is bringing hit series Widow's Bay to theatres for one night only. So it's a special screening of the final three episodes in select AMC theatres in the United States. Apple and Major League Baseball announced their September Friday Night Baseball schedule, which is not all that exciting. And first ever broadcast in Apple Immersive. In other words, four of the seven are being broadcast in VR. The first VR match has already aired, and based on the reviews I have read and which are linked in the show notes, it is actually quite successful. Jason Snell has a good take, John Voorhees has a really good take, and John Gruber has a summary of everyone else's take and his own take, and I kind of, there's one standout word for me in Gruber's coverage, and Gruber's a giant big baseball fan, so I take his coverage with the as being the most interesting. The word that really struck me was magic. It felt like being in the ballpark. Fascinating to read. I'm not into baseball, but it sounded interesting. Sounded like Apple did a really good job of it, so interesting to see. Apple TV, of course, continued to scoop up awards. I've long stopped reporting on nominations because they get so many of those. But, you know, real awards are still worth mentioning. Apple TV hits big at Critic Choice Super Awards with 5 wins, Widow's Bay and Pluribus taking home the trophies. And Apple TV Comedy Shrinking secures 4 trophies at the Astra Awards. Some CarPlay news. Apple CarPlay is coming to pontoon boats, starting with 2027 models. So Pontoon is a brand that make boats in the United States, and their Balise model and their Crest Conquest and Caribbean boats will be getting CarPlay. Which, I wonder, will they rename it Vehicle Play if it goes beyond just cars? I know we've had motorbikes with CarPlay, so I guess it's already gone beyond just the car. Interesting thought, though. Especially for people living in Europe, where the Volvo EX90 is a very popular model of car, you may be happy to know that your CarPlay is getting a little update. You are getting spatial audio. And to anyone who uses CarPlay anywhere in the world, who likes the idea of talking to AI chatbots in their car, you don't have to wait for Siri AI. Meta, their chatbot, is now live in CarPlay. And finally, Carolina prepares to support Apple Wallet driver's licenses. And for anyone else in the United States who's not quite sure where their state stands on this, the Mac Observer collected together a full list of all of the states that have announced but not yet delivered on their Apple Wallet support. That is linked in the show notes at les-talk.ie. We have just 3 main stories this month. We have a very significant handing over of the guard as the Tim Cook era ends and the John Ternus era begins. We have changes to Apple's App Store in the European Union. And this time, they're not just Apple throwing something at the wall and hoping that the European Commission agree that it should stick. This time, they've actually come to an agreement with the European Union. So this would appear to be the final answer for the next couple of years at least. And then thirdly, Apple surprised us with some new Mac hardware. Main story number one, then, is a changing of the guard. And this is extremely significant, in my opinion, because in as long as I have been an Apple fan, this is the first drama-free changing of CEOs. I mean, Steve Jobs, on the one hand, had done a lot to prepare for his departure as CEO by, you know, very much cultivating Tim Cook. And Tim Cook appears to have been quite instrumental in making sure the board had an excellent transition plan and so forth, and setting up Apple University and stuff. You know, Steve Jobs did understand the importance of handing on the baton, but in the end, whether it was through self-denial or whether it was through just an acceleration of the cancer at the end, I can't possibly tell, but in the end it did sort of sneak up on everyone. I know Tim Cook has mentioned how much of a surprise it was, even though mainly possibly because Steve had been sick for so long and everyone sort of assumed he was settling into a seat on the board and that he would be there for a long time, the same way that Bill Gates was on the board of Microsoft for ages. He might still be, for all I know. But that wasn't what happened, and it ended up being quite a drama. And, you know, that was a rough transition. This isn't that. This is the most orderly and, I guess, Tim Cook-like transition you could possibly imagine. Well-planned and well-executed. So we've known since the start of this year that in September, Tim Cook would move from the CEO role up to heading the board of directors, and John Ternus would move from leading hardware to becoming the new CEO. And that happened on the 1st of September, so yesterday, as I recorded this. And in the lead up to the transition, you know, as the date came closer, there was ever more of the two of them being seen together, including a rather comical visit to Apple Park and their giant big rainbow by Pikachu and some of the other Pokemon. And they met Tim and John. Yes, I guess it's a fun sort of introduction to the media. I thought it was worth mentioning anyway. Tim Cook also got a fancy pants farewell party to thank him for his work, I guess. And then on the last day of August, Tim took his final bow and exited. He sent quite a long memo to staff thanking them for their work. If you want to read the full text, it's in the linked Apple Insider story, lessagetalk.ie. And I'm just going to snippet out a few little excerpts here that really stood out to me. The truth is, whatever there is to say about my success, I know it is all because of you. So this is a memo to Apple staff. You have brought out the best in me. I am most proud of what an annual report could never capture. This place is proof that culture triumphs over everything. We share a belief that what we build matters and that we have both the opportunity and the responsibility to leave the world better than we found it. Together, we have created something far greater than any of us could have imagined or accomplished alone. And that's the secret to our success. We bring out the best in each other. We lift each other up. We have made it possible to leave our dent in the universe, as Steve once described it. And there was more to it, and a lot of it felt very Tolkien-esque in the way that Tim tries very hard to sound sincere and somehow manages to miss a lot of the time. But those particular passages, they struck me as particularly sincere and more emotional and more open than we're used to seeing Tim. Tim also posted a message to all of us, to the Apple community on Apple's website. And I won't quote it all, but some snippets do stand out. The first bit that stands out to me is actually he chose to open the email by talking about the emails from Apple users he reads every morning. You share little pieces of your lives with me and tell me things you want me to know about how Apple has touched you. About the moment your mom was saved by her Apple Watch. About the perfect selfie you captured at the summit of a mountain that seemed impossible to climb. You thank me for the ways Mac has changed what you can do at work. And sometimes give me a hard time because something you care about isn't working like it should. In every one of those emails, I feel the beating heart of our shared community. I feel a sense of deepening obligation to work harder and push further. But most of all, I feel a gratitude that I cannot put into words, that I somehow got to be the person on the other end of those emails, the leader of a company that ignites imaginations and enriches lives in such profound ways, and it defies description. Again, that seems truly heartfelt to me. He then went on, talked about a few other things, but then he went on to describe John Ternus, which I think is also an interesting, you know, so what does Tim Cook want us to know about John Ternus? He described him as a brilliant engineer and thinker who has spent the past 25 years building the Apple products our users love so much, obsessed with every detail, focused on every possible way we can make something better, bolder, more beautiful, and more meaningful. He is the perfect person for the job. Does that description remind you of any former Apple CEOs? That is the most job, you know, without saying he's Steve Jobs number two. He's kind of pointing out that there's a lot more jobs in Ternus than there ever would be in Tim Cook. John Gruber had an interesting insight with, you know, accompanying some snippets from these posts. You know, John noted that a lot of it felt very formulaic in the way many Tim Cook things do, but some bits of it, John pointed out, felt heartfelt. And I can't remember if John's snippets agree with my snippets, but again, he pointed out some of them. And then John said something that struck me as very clever. The fact that even now, when this is Tim Cook being the openest he's ever been, he's still very reserved. That is, in fact, Tim Cook being completely and open and honest with us. He is, in fact, a very private person. And to back that up, he gave a quote that Tim Cook gave to Walter Isaacson for the Jobs biography. And this is before Tim Cook became CEO. It really does underline that Tim Cook never, ever wanted to be an open political figure in a Jobsian way. Let me just get the quote here. Some people resent the fact that Steve gets credit for everything. Remember, this is before Jobs died, so it's still in the present tense. Some people resent the fact that Steve Jobs gets credit for everything, but I've never given a rat's ass about that. Wow, is that ever frank and honest, Tim Cook? Sorry, back to the quote. Frankly speaking, I prefer my name never to be in the paper. Well, that's not quite how it went, but it does sort of give you the idea that public Tim Cook was an imposition on Tim Cook's nature. Public Steve Jobs was just who Steve Jobs was. So I think given that insight into his true nature, he hasn't done too bad of a job of being, you know, a human leading Apple all of these 15 years. And particularly these last few months, he's been a little bit more open and a little bit more pensive. So I do kind of like it. Once Tim was finished signing off, the next day, 1st of September 2026, John Ternus made his entry. Apple's leadership page was updated, reflect both Tim and John's new roles. So the Mac Observer have a nice screenshot of showing the new status quo. And of course, John Ternus's picture now links to an updated profile page, which I'm also linking in the show notes, lessashtalk.ie. And a few people have been calling attention to some interesting analysis from Mike Hurley, because he read John Ternus's new executive profile and realized that three narratives from it really struck him. And having read Mike Hurley's post and having read the actual bio, I agree. So the three things that really stood out to Mike were that John is a hardware guy. That the description really leans into the hardware experience, which again strikes me as very much calling back to the Steve Jobs era. Very surprisingly, really quite near the top, is a strong focus on reliability and durability, which isn't what I would have immediately assumed you would put in a corporate bio, but maybe that's actually bang on the right tone to strike in a RAM and chip constrained world where prices are going way high because of geopolitics and of these physical constraints. So maybe that's very clever. And then the third thing that Mike pointed out is environmental impact and CO2 specifically gets a call out. So that is a welcome continuation to one of Tim's biggest priorities. So I thought that was, we won't really know what the turn of zero looks like until a few years from now when we can look back, but it's an interesting insight into John Turnus's desires for his era, whether or not he succeeds, I guess. He also sent a memo to staff, full text in the Apple Insider article linked in the show notes. Most of it is just an acknowledgement of and a thanks to Tim. Just a small amount, really, of forward-looking stuff, but I did think it was worth quoting. It's quite near the end, I think. I am so excited about everything we have in store. We have a huge launch next week that's going to be phenomenal. Thanks for everything you've all done to make it possible. I'm just as excited about what lies beyond that, including the incredible products already in the works and the ones we haven't even imagined yet that we'll dream up and create together. That's quite poetic. Again, sounds good to me. We shall see what happens. As is not unusual for Apple executives, John Turnus has not had a social media profile while he was not in the major, major top job. Now he is in the major, major top job, so he has joined X with a profile that's simply his name and a bio that simply says Apple CEO. And he made a very, very, very simple first post. In Mac-like way, he simply said, "Hello." We'll see much more next week, obviously. We also got a little peek under the hood of his pay. Obviously, moving up to the top job brings a pay increase. He is going to get a big pay rise compared to what he gets now, but he will be starting out at less money than Tim Cook ended up at. Which is, again, not surprising. He's a new CEO, not a very established CEO. So the last full year for Tim Cook is 2025, and we know his earnings for 2025, it was $74.3 million. Not bad. Based on the filings and details we know so far, the first full year for John Turnus, which will be 2027, will see him being paid $58 million. Again, not to be sneezed at, but less than 74. Now, he may also earn himself some bonuses on top of that, and a small subtlety. So both for Tim Cook and for John Turnus, the vast, vast, vast majority of their compensation is in the form of stock options. But Tim Cook had a $2 million base pay. John Turnus is getting a $3 million base pay. So Tim Cook is taking more, or took in 2025, more stock options, and stock options were a bigger chunk of his salary. John Turnus, on the other hand, is still getting a lot of stock, but he's getting more of a base salary. Not sure what to make of that, but them be the facts. I don't think it should be surprising that this moment of very obvious transition is being used for a wider changing of the guard. And I don't think this is a case of throwing out people. I think this is a case of people who had been gently stepping towards the door for some time, saying, "And I'm going to grab my coat too." Basically, "Oh, look, everyone else is leaving. The main guest is leaving the party. I think I shall go too." Now, an interesting one piece of news that is unconfirmed, last I saw anyway, is that John Turnus has actually reached back into his own history and asked a retired VP of hardware engineering, Laura Legros, to come out of retirement. Again, we have no official title because none of this is confirmed, but apparently she will be some sort of a special assistant to John Turnus and will report to him with some sort of a VP title. But now back to the old guard leaving. Apple fellow and former senior vice president for worldwide marketing Phil Schiller is taking another step back. So he had took one step back to become a fellow. But while he was a fellow, he still retained responsibility for running Apple events and for running the App Store. This is, again, unconfirmed, but it seems well-sourced. According to the sources, Phil Schiller's deputy, Nola Weinstein, will be taking over Apple events, and Eddie Q will be taking back the App Store. Eddie Q had the App Store then and went to fellow Phil Schiller, and now is going back to Eddie Q. Phil Schiller is not leaving completely. He is moving on to work on, quote, unspecified initiatives. The former chief financial officer, Luca Maestri, is reportedly stepping back a lot further. He is handing over his, he has in fact handed over his last remaining leadership role as vice president of corporate services in the last few weeks. Apparently he's only seen on campus one day a week now, because the only thing that anyone knows that he's still doing is teaching what is apparently a very popular course in the Apple University, which is Apple's internal training center set up by Steve Jobs. What we also know, according to the report, is that the chief financial officer, Kevin Parekh, is taking over those last few responsibilities that Luca Maestri had held on to when he stepped back as CFO. That makes all the sense in the world. So, with that, the John Ternus era is off. And the first picture of what that might look like will emerge throughout the month of September, which we will talk about in next month's show. Our second main story, then, is a rare agreement between the European Commission and, frankly, any major US tech firm. Not an edict, not an, oh, is this okay, please, but an actual agreement that both sides agree on. We have new developer terms and services for the European Union, particularly new App Store rates and so forth. So Apple released a press release detailing everything. That's linked in the show notes. But I'll give you a summary of some of the highlights or some of the key points. App Store apps using Apple's in-app purchases will charge a 26% commission by default. All subscription renewals are at 15%. Developers in the App Store small business programs, a mini app partner program, and video partner program will also be at 15%. App Store apps using alternative payment processing will get a 20% commission by default. And developers in the small business program, mini apps partner program, and video partner program will be down to 10%. So it's basically 5%-ish less. The App Store apps that link out to complete purchases will be a 15% commission by default. Developers in the App Store small business program, mini apps partner program, and video partner program will be at 10%. It's basically the same as a previous level of stuff for a large part. And apps distributed via alternative app marketplaces or the web will pay a 5% core technology commission, which means that for free apps, it's 5% of nothing, which is a big improvement over the biggest problem with the alternative markets, where free and open source apps that were entirely non-commercial still had to pay a core technology fee based on download. And that's problematic. If you get a big success in your hand, your free app costs you money instead of your users. All of that is gone. On the whole, oh yeah, there were some other details. It used to be the case that European developers had to choose between the special Europe-only contract or the traditional European contract before any of these changes were made. That is now, all of that has just been simplified. This is the terms for all EU developers. If a European developer signs up to be in the App Store, this is what they sign up to, no having to choose which contract you'd like. Apple got agreement from the Commission that they could impose child safety protections, even on apps in other stores. And they've also made it easier to get approval to run on alternative app marketplace, because some of those barriers really were ridiculously high. It was obvious they were attempting to make it impossible to do so. And so there's been a little bit of a give there. There's an excellent summary of everything that changed from Apple Insider linked in the show notes. And I wasn't initially sure if this was agreed by the European Commission. Apple just announced it. And I didn't know if this would be the end of the matter, if this was Apple's next gambit. But that was followed quite promptly by an official statement from the European Commission, which I will quote. The Commission welcomes Apple's changes to their business terms, which follow a close dialogue between the Commission and Apple after the Commission issued a non-compliance decision related to Apple's steering terms, as well as preliminary findings related to alternative app distribution, both in April 2025. Not all that exciting, but basically, under Margarita Vestager, the Commission never negotiated. You were almost playing a guessing game with what would satisfy the Commission. One of the things I've noticed is the new European Commission is a lot more level-headed, a lot less media-grabbing, and they seem to be keen to live up to the, frankly, the letter of the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act, which both say that the Commission will work with companies to help them be compliant. And that was not true under Vestager's remit. She absolutely made a point of being as antagonistic as possible. It would appear things have changed. And on the whole, as a European and a tech fan, this is good. This gives me some hope that Siri AI may make its way over here at some stage. We shall see. Predictably, or as Apple Insider put it in a headline too good to pass over, predictable as the tides, Epic Games hates the new EU App Store fees. Again, anything above zero is too much for Epic. John Gruber offers a well-reasoned Eurosceptic analysis. Myself and John Gruber do not agree on a lot of things about the EU. I think John has a point most of the time, and I agree with him like 33% of the way, and then he goes too far and I disagree with him the other 66% of the way. But in this case, his actual summary is extremely fair, and I can't fault it. So if you want to get basically all of that faffing about for a measly few percent, is kind of John's argument, and he lays out the math, he lays out the numbers, and you know something? I'm not sure he's wrong. We could have gotten here a heck of a lot more quickly. A heck of a lot more quickly had the Commission lived up to the spirit and letter of the law from day one instead of being so adversarial and basically playing the media for a couple of years. So do you know something? Yeah, I think you're right, John. This is an awful, awful, awful hard way to get to something that isn't all that significant. I think it's valuable. I just think we should have gotten here in one go, within a year, not in this mad stretch-out process. Our third and final main story then is some, to me anyway, unexpected new Mac hardware. Apple unveiled M6 and M5 Ultra chips with, as Apple PR put it, huge CPU, GPU and AI upgrades. At this stage, I don't think there's really much more to say other than Apple Silicon is getting better and it was already bloody great. And really, it's just a little bit more of all the goodness we have already. That really is the summary here of these new chips. These new chips have a new home. Apple's new, again, I'm just going to quote Apple's press release because it describes it pretty well. Apple's new Mac Mini featuring M6 and M5 Pro delivers a massive leap in AI performance, supercharging the leading desktop for always-on agentic computing. Yeah, notice how Apple has noticed that the biggest market for the little Mac Mini is no longer switchers. It is the AI community because those chips are really bloody good at running AI stuff and they're small little boxes you can put in a corner somewhere. And the new Mac Minis keep their 3 display limit for those of you who actually use the Mac Mini as a desktop. But the refresh rate has gone up and 3 displays isn't too bad. And the M6 Mac Mini versus the M4, the Mac Observer have a nice little comparison table. You know, how much has changed? Apple then also introduced a new Mac Studio. Again, I'm going to quote Apple's press release. Apple introduces new Mac Studio at M5 Max and M5 Ultra, the ultimate desktop for on-device AI and the most extreme pro workflows. For the most part, the same is true of the Mini, by the way. No new industrial design or anything. This is just the chip boost, and the chip boosts are just basically more of the same. Interestingly, though, the Mac Studio does get it leans into its pro workflows bit. Obviously, it's a great AI machine, too. But it's also a machine for video editing. And Apple have leaned into that as well because they have added native support for something called GenLock into the Mac Studio. And this is a technology for automatically aligning video clips from different sources. I don't know a lot about how it works, but it obviously needs some sort of a hardware component, and that is now built into the Mac Studio. And that does make it a very, very good video editing tool for people with, you know, multi-camera videos to edit together. So it's an interesting development. As expected, the prices have risen substantially. We all knew this was going to be the case given, you know, the supply constraints at the moment. John Gruber has a nice table showing you exactly how high those prices are. Link in the show notes at letsjusttalk.ie. These new models will launch on September 27th with macOS Golden Gate, which tells us that the Apple OS 27s will be out sometime between now and the 22nd of September. And Apple also made some other small changes. They have updated
their Magic keyboards. No price increase, which is probably the biggest headline. Other than the no price increase, the biggest change is in how the keys are physically labeled on the keyboard. They now match the way MacBook keyboards are physically labeled. And Apple have expanded their improved 40-watt dynamic power adapter with 60-watt max to Europe and Vietnam. I was quite jealous of those improved US chargers. I am very happy that they have now arrived in Europe. So thank you, Apple. And one of the weirdest stories to make the news is that there was one product that got a discount. Apple reduced the price of their infamous polishing cloth. It has gone down from $19 to $9, and it is apparently softer than the original. I don't know if soft is a feature or a bug, but it's a difference anyway, and it's less than half the price. In related news, Apple has increased the device trade-in payouts for iPhone, iPad, and Mac users. This is purely speculation from me here, but is the RAM shortage making older parts more valuable? Is the market for refurbs now increased in value because there are fewer new machines being made because all the chips are going into AI data centers? I can't see how that wouldn't be a factor. Don't know how much of a factor it is, but anyway, more money for trading in your old tech. That's only a good thing. And finally, Apple launches a redesigned accessories store with better search in categories in their website. This is very important if you want some accessories for your shiny new Macs. As usual, we'll finish with some other quick stories that made the news in August 2026. Things are getting a little bit easier for Mac users who also use Windows. Microsoft Edge is adding Apple account sign-in on Mac and Windows. So at the moment, if you want to sync your settings in Edge, you have to sign into a Microsoft account. I happen to have one. I happen to do that because that makes the most sense for me, even though I'm only a Mac user and not a Windows user. But now you can be a switcher between the two, Mac OS and Windows, and you don't need a Microsoft account. You can have your Microsoft Edge settings follow you from your Mac over to Windows. And you know something? Safari, I think, is probably still the best browser on the Mac, in my opinion. But in my opinion, the second best browser on the Mac with the least bloaty faff is, in fact, Edge. So this actually might be genuinely useful to a lot of people. Apple have also added some more options for those of you dealing with hearing loss. The Made for iPhone Hearing Devices program has 43 additional new certified models that you can use to add proper hearing aids to your iPhone. And Apple has become the first brand to be honored by the Creative Hall of Fame. Previously, the Creative Hall of Fame only honored individual people. They have in the past honored Steve Jobs, but they've decided to expand to create a new award to complement their award for individuals, to award brands that have made a many year substantial contribution to design. Well, Apple seems like a very good first winner of that award, and that's exactly what happened. So the new award, Apple get the first one. And finally, Apple have announced that September 9th will be its next and very much expected September event. We all expect some sort of iPhone. They have christened it Surprise and Shine. Yet again, a pun. I don't think we can really read anything more into it than that Apple have dad sense of humour and just like a good pun. So Rise and Shine becomes Surprise and Shine, yay. People love doing criminology on this. Someone took the Chinese version of the announcement and ran it through Google Translate. And Google Translate seems to think that the alt text on the image says, "A new chapter unfolds, dazzling and brilliant." That may or may not simply be an artifact of how Chinese idioms translate into English, and maybe nothing more than an idiosyncrasy of Google Translate, or it might be a teaser that we are getting a foldable iPhone in September. Who knows? It seems almost certain there will be iPhones of some sort. Foldable is, I would say, possibly probable rather than likely, but anyway, we'll see what we see when we see it, which will be on the 9th of September. With that, I am going to draw a line under this month's Apple News. Thank you for joining me as I digest it for you.
Again, a reminder, you will find detailed show notes with links to all of the stories that have informed my thinking on this month's Apple News at letstalk.ie. You are now approaching the end of the show. There's no real content left, just me blathering on for a bit more. And you have not heard a single advertisement or a single sponsor read. And you can keep listening all the way to the very end of my nice theme tune and my nice little audio icon. And at no point will you hear any such ad or endorsement or sponsorship or anything like that. Because this show is 100% listener supported. It is amazing folk like you who make it possible for me to produce an Apple News show with zero conflicts of interest. That is something I have always wanted to do. The thing I hated most about podcasting was the having to beg for advertisers and then having to not make advertisers cranky and all that kind of stuff. And I really, really, really do not want to be beholden to others and have to filter my opinions. What is the point in you listening to my opinions if they're filtered by people who open their wallet to me? And because this community rocks, I don't have to do that. The intention here is not that this is my career. I have a career. I quite like my career. This is something I want to do at a break-even pace. I put a lot of time and effort into it, but I really don't mind as long as I don't also have to put a lot of my own money into it. And we are close to, but not quite at, breaking even. I would like us to be at breaking even by this time next year so I don't have to make another injection of my own money to keep the Artificial Creations Limited Media Company afloat. I want that limited company to have equal income and expenditure. All of this is a way for me to say you will find links to support the show at letstalk.ie. You can become a monthly Patreon contributor. The Patreon donors really, really help me pay the monthly bills. There are bills that come in every month. There is Patreon money that comes in every month. And in an ideal world, those two will cancel each other out perfectly. But every now and then, I also have one-time expenses, and that's where the PayPal button is amazing. So some people choose not to make a monthly commitment, which is entirely reasonable, and instead to make a one-off donation. And if you do that with PayPal, that is money that, in my mind, is available for me to make needed software and hardware updates as and when is required, and any other expenses I incur as part of running this show. Thank you very much to everyone who has ever supported the show in any way, and that very much includes simply spreading the word. Simply sharing news of the show is supporting the show. The bigger the audience, the more people there are who can choose to contribute financially. Sharing is caring. I swear, really, really, when it comes to podcasting, sharing is caring. So I thank you all who have ever or will ever support the show in any way whatsoever. Okay, I've rattled on for definitely long enough at this stage. I've been your host, Bart Bouchotts. You can find my personal stuff at bartb.ie. And until next month, happy computing.